Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. With our regular pattern of programming at this time of week, bringing you, as always, a chat with Joan Lewis, who's just returned from the United Kingdom. But first, Jill Bevilacqua's There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. For this, the 26th Sunday in Ordinary Time, which begins with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us.
Jesus said to the Pharisees, "Once there was a rich man who dressed in purple and linen and feasted splendidly every day. At his gate lay a beggar named Lazarus, who was covered with sores. Lazarus longed to eat the scraps that fell from the rich man's table. The dogs even came and licked his sores. Eventually the beggar died. He was carried by angels to the bosom of Abraham. The rich man likewise died and was buried. From the abode of the dead, where he was in torment, he raised his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus resting in his bosom. He called out, 'Father Abraham, have pity on me. Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water to refresh my tongue, for I am tortured in these flames.' 'My child,' replied Abraham, 'remember that you were well off in your lifetime, while Lazarus was in misery. Now he has found consolation here, but you have found torment. And that is not all. Between you and us there is fixed a great abyss, so that those who might wish to cross from here to you cannot do so, nor can anyone cross from your side to us.' 'Father, I ask you then,' the rich man said, 'send him to my father's house, where I have five brothers. Let him be a warning to them, so that they may not end in this place of torment.' Abraham answered, 'They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them.' 'No, Father Abraham,' replied the rich man, 'but if someone would only go to them from the dead, then they would repent.' Abraham said to him, 'If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if one should rise from the dead.'"
The parable of today's gospel has long been known as that of Dives and Lazarus. But while both old and present-day versions give the poor man a name, the rich man only came to be known as Dives because it was the Latin word for rich. Pope John Paul II issued an encyclical, the opening words of which were Dives Misericordiae, rich in mercy. In a 1930s dictionary, the word Dives appears with the explanation, commonly taken as the proper name of the rich man in the parable, see Luke 16, and used generically for rich man. In a present-day dictionary, it appears in capital letters with this definition, a typical or hypothetical rich man, and it's preceded by the words poetic or literary. But it adds that its origin is Middle English from Late Latin, used in the Vulgate translation of the Bible. Dives then was only fictitious, but in fact there was a Roman politician who was known as Dives because he was the richest of Roman citizens. He was a friend of Julius Caesar, and in the year 60 BC formed the first triumvirate with him and Pompey. His real name, by the way, was Marcus Licinius Crassus. But to our parable. In order to emphasise the difference between the two protagonists, Jesus presents the first as living in the lap of luxury and dressed in the finest clothes and dining on the choicest of foods, while the second languishes in abject poverty and disease. Our rich man dressed in purple, we hear, and purple is the colour we usually associate with Lent, with the sacrament of reconciliation or penance, as it was formerly called. Dating from 1466, we read, "It was the hue of mourning, especially royal or ecclesiastical mourning, or of penitence. But in ancient Greece and Rome, purple robes were a mark of dignity and were worn by kings, magistrates, and military commanders. And what do we read in Mark's account of the Passion when Jesus was delivered into the hands of the Roman soldiers?
They dressed him up in purple, twisted some thorns into a crown and put it on him, and they began saluting him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They struck his head with a reed and spat on him, and they went down on their knees to do him homage. And when they had finished making fun of him, they took off the purple and dressed him in his own clothes.
In later times, born to the purple came to mean someone born into a reigning family or privileged class. But in antiquity, purple was also a symbol of power and luxury. The phrase, the purple, was a synonym for the rank of Roman emperor, from the colour of his dyed woolen robe. And from Roman times, purple has been used in the insignia of emperors, kings and prelates. When a man's made a cardinal, in fact, we say that he has been raised to the purple, although in fact his official dress is red. But in the dictionary, purple is defined as a colour falling midway between red and blue in hue. So that explains it. The most famous purple was Tyrian purple, a dye very costly to produce. It was obtained from a mixture of shellfish, murex and purpura, mollusks related to snails and whelks and found by the Phoenician port of Tyre on the Mediterranean coast, as our traveller writes.
On the beach near Tyre, I saw the thin-coloured seashell from which in ancient times the famous Tyrian purple was made.
The Hebrews valued purple goods very highly, we read in a manual on life in Babel times, and it refers to a woman mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles.
The New Testament tells us that Lydia was a seller of purple in the city of Thyatira. Thyatira was famous for its cloth dyers, so we assume that Lydia dealt in cloth of purple and possibly in the dye itself.
Lydia was the woman Paul and his companions met by the river outside the gates of Philippi, where she and other women had gathered for prayer. In the versions of the Acts I have been looking at, Lydia is said to have been from the town of Thyatira. Today's guidebook tells us that it is a small town in western Turkey, some 100 kilometres from Smyrna. A biblical scholar writes that Thyatira was in Lydia, from which the woman takes her name. Lydia is important for us because she and her family formed the first Christian nucleus of the European continent. Philippi, a town in Macedonia in northeast Greece, was Paul's first landing point in Europe.
A prosperous city, thriving on the trade which passed along the Via Agasia, the road built by the Romans to connect Asia Minor with Italy. Following the activities of Paul, it readily abandoned its pagan gods and adopted Christianity.
Previously, Philippi owed its fame to the great battle fought there in 42 BC, when the armies of Brutus and Cassius were defeated by those of Octavian and Mark Antony, an event which marked the end of the Roman Republic. Apart from the distinguishing mark of purple, the rich man in the parable is also dressed in linen, fine linen, most other versions have, and this is an important distinction, as the manual notes.
Linen was a versatile fabric that could be made coarse and thick or very fine and delicate. The Egyptians had a wide reputation for their fine linen, which was nearly transparent. They also made coarse linen that was so heavy that it could be used for carpets to cover the floors. Egyptians of the Nile Valley developed linen cloth, virtually the lightest of clothing materials, to offset the effects of the sweltering sun in their area. The Egyptians preferred the sheerest of linens. The fine linen fabrics were worn by those with positions of status or wealth, and the coarser fabrics were worn by the common people. The Egyptians clothed Joseph in fine linen when they made him ruler. The curtains, veil and door hangings of the Hebrew tabernacle were made of fine linen, as were the hangings for the gate of the court or for the court itself. The ephod, an apron-like garment and breastplate of the high priest, contained fine linen. The mitre, or upper turban, The official headdress of the high priest was made of fine linen and had many folds and a total length of about 8 yards. This long cloth was wound about the head in turban style. The tunic, girdle and breeches worn by all priests were made of fine white linen, and during their temple ministrations the priests also wore robes of white linen. The Jews made their inner garments or underclothing primarily of linen. The grave clothes of Jesus were made from this fabric. Joseph of Arimathea bought a shroud of linen for the purpose, writes Mark, and Joseph, buying fine linen and taking him down, wrapped him in the fine linen.
And in conclusion, we read that fine white linen was also a symbol of innocence and moral purity. And the writer refers us to the book of Revelation, where the seven angels came out wearing pure white linen, fastened round their waists with golden girdles. Back in the 19th century, a young woman of 25, Cecil Frances Alexander, published a collection of hymns for little children, which became immensely popular. One of the best known of these, All Things Bright and Beautiful, is still sung today. But there's one verse which is no longer sung. To do so would be, shall we say, at the very least, politically incorrect.
The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high or lowly, and ordered their estate.
The poor man at the gate of Dives Castle was not only a beggar, but was covered with sores. Such a pitiful specimen of humanity that the dogs are moved to lick his sores. In the Bible there's a real-life Lazarus, the brother of Martha and Mary, who dies and is brought back to life by Jesus. So Lazarus was a real name. But as a result of the parable, it came to mean a beggar, or leper, or both. A proper name, used allusively, was a definition of 1508. Then there was the word Lazar, now archaic, which one modern dictionary defines as one afflicted with a repulsive disease. Lazar was simply an adaptation of the medieval Latin Lazarus, an application of the proper name Lazarus. The old dictionary defines it as a poor and diseased person, usually one afflicted with a loathsome disease, especially a leper. Our poor man was not a leper, or he would certainly not have been allowed to sit at the rich man's gate. In our Lord's time, lepers had to live at a distance from the healthy community. But even a couple of centuries ago, an isolation hospital for those with infectious diseases, especially leprosy or plague, was known as a lazaret, or lazaretto. In 1803, when Elizabeth Seton and her husband Will, who was tubercular, arrived in Leghorn, their ship was not allowed to dock, for fear it had brought yellow fever from New York, and the Setons spent a month in quarantine in the lazaretto. Wrote Elizabeth.
An immense prison, bolted in, a single window, double grated with iron, through which, if I should want anything, I am to call a sentinel with a cocked hat and long rifled gun, that is, that he may not receive the dreadful infection we are supposed to have brought with us from New York.
Will Seton survived only a month after their release from the lazaretto. The Lazarus in the parable longed to eat the scraps that fell from the rich man's table. But he's not allowed even that. It's a very extreme parable. Dives doesn't lift a finger to help Lazarus. And when he dies and goes to hell, he calls on Abraham to send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water so as to cool his tongue. Just the tip of his finger, no more. But he had never thought of offering Lazarus even the proverbial cup of cold water. If anyone gives so much as a cup of cold water to one of these little ones. St. John Chrysostom, 4th century Greek doctor of the church, was brought up, we're told, in surroundings of splendour and affluence. But Maisie Ward, in her book Early Church Portrait Gallery, compared him to St. Basil the Great in his passionate love for the poor, in his hope to change the ordinary careless Christian into a man with an outlook like his own. Not only did he urge men to give freely, he attacked ill-gotten riches. but he stretched the idea of ill-gotten riches very far. Even if you had not robbed the poor yourself, were you sure about the wealth you inherited? And he demanded charity on the scale of the gospel.
You make no difficulty about boarding and lodging soldiers at the demand of the civil authority. You will not do the same for the poor at the demand of Christ. Yet the poor are your defenders against the devil, as the soldiers are against the barbarians. All of you should have guest houses in proportion to your income. Set apart a room in your dwelling for the guest, that is, for Christ. Put a servant in charge, choose the best you have, to receive the poor and sick, and to wait upon them. If you will not make this sacrifice and let Lazarus sit by your family hearth, at least shelter him in your stable. Yes, give Christ shelter in your stable. You shudder at this idea, but it is far worse to shut the door in his face.
And Maisie Ward writes,
there was already at Antioch a church centre for the needy. It was not enough for John. He wanted them welcomed voluntarily at the town gates and taken home, not for their own sakes only, but for the good of their hosts.
And let's close with an anonymous poem, or rather a ballad, entitled Dives and Lazarus.
As it fell out upon a day, rich Dives, he made a feast, and he invited all his friends and gentry of the best. Then Lazarus laid him down and down, and down at Dives' door. Some meat, some drink, brother Dives, bestow upon the poor. Thou art none of my brother Lazarus, that lies begging at my door. No meat nor drink will I give thee, nor bestow upon the poor. Then Lazarus laid him down and down, and down at Dives' wall. Some meat, some drink, brother Dives, or with hunger starve I shall. Then Dives sent out his merry men to whip poor Lazarus away. They had no power to strike a stroke, but flung their whips away. Then Dives sent out his hungry dogs to bite him as he lay. They had no power to bite at all, but licked his sores away. As it fell out upon a day, poor Lazarus sickened and died. Then came two angels out of heaven, his soul therein to guide. Rise up, brother Lazarus, and go along with me, for you've a place prepared in heaven to sit on an angel's knee. As it fell out upon a day, rich Dives sickened and died. Then came two serpents out of hell, his soul therein to guide. Rise up, brother Dives, and go with us to see a dismal place prepared in hell to sit on a serpent's knee. Then Dives looked up with his eyes and saw poor Lazarus blessed. Give me one drop of water, brother Lazarus, to quench my flaming thirst. Or had I as many years to abide as there are blades of grass, then there would be an end. But now hell's pains will ne'er be past. Or was I now but alive again, the space of one half hour, or that I had my peace secure, then the devil should have no power.
And warm thanks there once again to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at the same time next week. Meanwhile, as announced earlier on in the broadcast, let's join our expert on all things Vatican, Joan Lewis, who's just returned from the United Kingdom, where, as she'll tell you in a moment, she was reporting on Pope Benedict XVI's visit there. So, Joan, welcome back after the summer. It's been a long time.
It has, exactly. The summer vacation, I came back from the States and then had 48 hours to get ready, unpack, do some work, and pack again for London to cover the Pope's trip. And I just also got back from that trip, so it's been a whirlwind.
Let's recall that it was from the 16th to the 19th of September, and it was a great success.
Oh, it was. And, you know, this may seem strange to sum it up this way, but as I was getting a taxi to Paddington Station to take me to the airport, the taxi driver had made some comment about, was I just visiting London for a vacation or whatever? And I said I was there to cover the papal trip for Catholic Media. And he said, well, I understand the Pope made a lot of new friends, and the trip was very good. So you have a taxi driver who summed up in a few words what eventually was...
Despite negative anticipations, which we won't go into.
Well, yes, exactly. A lot of the press before the visit made you kind of wonder if, you know, there was even the possibility for it, in the eyes of the media, to be successful. And the Pope was his charming, wonderful self, won so many people over. And beyond being charming and smiling and just a gentlemanly pontiff, his speeches were awesome. My two favorites, for very different reasons. I attended the Twickenham event on the very first day in England when
Catholic
he went to
St.
Mary's. Yes, he went to St. Mary's University College, and there were three different speeches there, one to leaders of other religions, one to educators, and then in the middle of those two, he met with young people. And it was just absolutely wonderful to see. And these were from Catholic schools all over the UK, and they were all linked up simultaneously via television and or internet. So there was not a student in the UK who, unless they were sick at home or something, would have missed the papal speech. But the beauty of that speech, the beauty of all of his speeches, really, unless maybe he's speaking to academics or a group that's solely theologians, it's the clarity of the Pope's words. His speech to young people, I have to say, was beautiful because of that. But he never talks down to people. But you know what? You could be 9, 19, or 79 and have loved the Pope's speech to the youth. It was all about how to become a saint. It was an easy path. Not that the path we live is easy, but he talked about role models. And he said, now, you know, think of somebody that you really love and admire, and they're a good person. They do wonderful things. And he said, you want to be like them? Well, you really can. And he just encouraged youth like a wonderful uncle or grandfather. And the other speech that I loved for drastically different reasons, because it touched on the world scene, of course, were his remarks at Westminster Hall to both houses of Parliament and to other invited guests. But again, the hallmark of his speeches, the clarity of his terms. He doesn't leave any doubts. And what is so beautiful about Pope Benedict's talks is that he says things choosing very carefully his words, even when he speaks off the cuff, which he did not do in a big event like Westminster. He very carefully chooses his words so that perhaps a thought or idea said by another person in another way might be offensive. And Pope Benedict very carefully chooses words to leave no doubt in your mind what he's talking about. Because, of course, at Westminster, I mean, the role of religion in society permeated, obviously, all of his talks, everything that he said. Because the term secular can be used very easily with the current British society, of course, and many others. But he talked about that role of religion in society, Catholic social teaching. He dared, if you will, which is what some people said, he dared to talk about St. Thomas More, who in that very hall had stuck to his Catholic conscience, his Catholic principles, and defied his king, for which reason he was tried, convicted, and of course, killed, martyred, really. The Pope talked about the role of conscience. He talked about ethics, the ethical foundation even, I mean, of politics and political systems. He talked about the modern moral dilemma. Is there an objective moral truth? Yes, there is. Obviously, another thing that permeated all of his talks in some way or another was the marriage of faith and reason. There is no reason why faith and reason cannot be together and be good friends in life. They don't have to be antagonists. Another highlight of many of the Pope's talks was the moral consequences of our actions. These can be tough issues for somebody who doesn't really want to think about morality or ethics, or they just want to think about power. There might be a politician or whatever. And so he takes these terms, but there's a gentleness to the way he employs them. And so he isn't offending you, but he is making you think. It's my impression that that was one of the biggest results of this trip. Wherever the Pope talked or gave a homily at a mass, starting in Bella Houston, obviously with the Queen in Scotland, and then his 3 days in England, he certainly came across as someone you did want to listen to. He made people think. And that's what I read in the press throughout the days that I was there and what I have heard and read subsequently. The strongest critics before the papal trip had to sit back and be honest with themselves. Those who were honest with themselves realized that the man had a message indeed that crossed could touch all people.
Of course, the trip ended with the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman, who the Pope has drawn inspiration from in his life long before becoming Pope.
Well, I was really wishing I had been in Birmingham. One of the difficult things for most of the media was getting to Birmingham. There were no trains that you could take at, let's say, 5 or 6 in the morning that would have gotten you from London to Birmingham. So you either had to skip the Hyde Park vigil, which was phenomenal, also focused on Blessed Newman. You either had to skip the Hyde Park vigil to go to Birmingham by train and take a hotel, but you still had to be in place. Whether you were a VIP or a parishioner traveling to Birmingham from London or elsewhere, you still had to be in place between 4:30 and 6 in the morning. So people waited between 4 and 6 and a half hours for this to take place. But you know what? The minute the Pope came on the scene, the minute he came to Coughton Field, everything changed. And people said it was worth the wait. They forgot the dampness. They forgot everything. They were there to see the Holy Father. They were there to see one of their own beatified. So the Mass, the ceremony, was extraordinarily beautiful and moving. And again, like you said, for the Holy Father. And he said at the Wednesday audience this week, where after a Pope takes a trip, the Wednesday audience after that is dedicated to the just concluded trip. He had wonderful moving words about Birmingham, about the beatification, about the meaning of John Henry Newman, now blessed, in his own life.
Of course, he broke his own rules in this occasion.
Yes.
Because he actually beatified someone for the first time in his pontificate.
Exactly. Personally. Well, what Pope Benedict did, I'm sure maybe our listeners are aware of this, what Pope Benedict did when he became Pope was go back to the old practice, which was a beatification would take place in the Diocese of the Blessed. A canonization would take place in Rome, be done by the Pope, because with the canonization you are saying to the world, here is a new saint. This is for universal veneration, whereas the beatification is more local. There's still another step. So for him to do this on this trip does indicate his love and admiration and respect for this very, very great man and England's newest blessed.
Well, thanks very much, Joan, and welcome back to Rome once again. You were listening there to Joan Lewis. She'll be back again at the same time next week. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.